So, is it working?
It is working. I'm here.
Yes. All right, so we got you there. Excellent. So let me describe your background for our listeners. And am I pronouncing it wrong or right? Baumeister?
Baumeister is correct.
Baumeister. Okay, so we got on the phone Roy F. Baumeister, Department of Psychology, the Florida State University, Tallahassee, Florida. And I was just reading from your paper on sexual economics. He's also the author of several books and edited many. These ones are more layman books. Is There Anything Good About Men? How Cultures Flourish by Exploiting Men. We were touching on culture and men's creation of culture. That's 2010. And then the other book here I have to note is Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. It's co-authored with John Tierney. That's 2011. And he is co-author with Kathleen Voss. I'm noting a woman here, of two interesting papers. And one was, we didn't talk about it, but it's called Sexual Economics, Sex as Female Resource for Social Exchange and Heterosexual Interactions, and also the one I was reading from, Sexual Economics, Culture, Men, and Modern Sexual Trends. So that's from the symposium Mating Games? Is that right?
I think that's right. There was a recent journal symposium with Regnerus's, based on Regnerus's work, and we were all asked to submit commentaries on it. So I... I was glad to do it. His work is quite interesting and provides interesting stuff consistent with what we found.
Cool. Yeah, I think it's cool. I was reading your work and you were referring to his work, and his was more of from a woman's perspective, and yours, you slanted it towards a man's perspective as I was reading it.
The focus is, much of his work is about how behaviors changed on college campuses with the shift from the male majority that was the preponderant for decades to now a female majority, the current situation. And as usual, and it's certainly consistent with the economic theory, if women are the sellers and men are the buyers in sex, then the so-called the price of sex, what the man has to do or give in order to get sex, that depends on supply and demand. So when for all those years when women were scarce and colleges were full of men, then the man really had to commit himself, and it was normal even to have to at least give an engagement ring before you started having intercourse. But now, with the preponderance of women, supply exceeds demand, and the man really doesn't have to do much, maybe more than a phone call or two in some cases, in order to get sex.
Wow. Maybe I'm doing something wrong then. I was theorizing based on what I've read in the Manosphere. Are you familiar with the Manosphere?
I had an email from somebody there the other day, but that was my first contact with it.
All right, it might have been me. I don't know. But basically a group of men were communicating online, like how something's changing. They were, one was the seduction community. How do we get sex? And because the whole idea of the marriage route was not working or seemed pretty scary, because with the idea of divorce becoming easier and custody and alimony issues. So do you think that it's really that easy for men to get sex? Because I think there is in the Manosphere, they call it a hypergamous tendency, where the woman wants the highest ranking status, like most sexy man she can get, for fun sex, whereas a provider man might provide dinner and stuff, and then maybe she would have different reasons to provide sex there, but it would be less passionate. The lover type seems to be more like Red Queen. I don't know if you've read Red Queen.
Mark Ridley's book.
Yes. So I don't know how easy it is. Is it easier for alpha men, but not easier for beta, or is it easier for men in general? What do you think on that?
Well, this is not my area, but the researchers I know who study things and track things a long time, certainly on college campuses, the impression is it's just generally easier for every man, maybe not at the low extreme, but just about everyone to have sex. There there's a big surplus of women and
women
for male attention there. Once you get out of college, then things sort out a bit, and it becomes harder to meet people and so on. I don't know a lot of studies yet with these new electronic dating fields and services and how they work. They've certainly transformed it. I mean, once you're out of college, you're sort of limited to a circle of friends and people you met through work and church and things like that. So the idea that, especially if you live in a big city, you can have hundreds, if not thousands, of potential mates just available online that you can go out with and see if that matches that. How that changes sexual behavior, I don't really know. It seemingly almost have to increase the total amount of sex that people are having. Now, you mentioned the issue of within a stable relationship. Well, there the contingencies change, and it looks, I can't swear this is true, but the data are kind of pointing that nature's prepared a somewhat nasty surprise that that single women and newly in love women have high desires for sex that may be close to what men desire. But once the woman settles into a stable relationship, she often gradually loses her interest in sex. So ironically, marriage for many men becomes a long period of sexual starvation. The data from various sources are suggesting that. There's a remarkable book called The Sex Diaries by a woman in Australia, Bettina Arndt, I think.
This concludes this test of the emergency alert system.
Well, that's a relief.
It's still going. All right, I think we got it now. Okay, so you're talking about the diaries that were like no sex and sexless marriage?
Lots of that. I mean, the man still wants to have sex and so on, but the woman often just loses interest. And not all women are like this, but it's very hard to predict which one. Pretty much they're all sure when they're dating and they're all hot for each other that it's just going to be like this forever. But lots of women seem to lose interest, and you know, the change is that traditionally women thought that was part of their obligation to take care of their husband's sexual desires, even if they didn't necessarily feel like it. Now, with the new entitlement, thanks to feminism, women don't feel that anymore. They think it's the man's job to wait until they're ready. Unfortunately, they aren't ready nearly as often, so that makes the deal. The man is still expected to contribute money, although the woman does contribute perhaps more than she used to. But the basic economic deal of the man contributes money and the woman contributes sex to the relationship, the terms of that has changed, and women don't feel the social obligation to do that anymore.
How far back does your does available research evidence go, and is it possible that when the men had popular sovereignty to a higher degree, when this is, you know, my hypothesis here, that is it possible that when men have more political power, instead of being told what to do, but popular sovereignty is really stronger, that these men in the rank and file are more dominant and therefore more attractive to their wives? And, you know, when you had a patriarchy, a civilized patriarchy, essentially, does the evidence show anything that women would be more interested of their own free will to have sex with their husbands in the long run?
Well, that's a good question. We don't have much evidence about sex in marriage for that. We did just publish a paper last year comparing different countries in the world now, looking at the inequality between the genders as rated by one of the UN Global Forum sites or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was an international sex survey for which we took the countrywide averages and so on, which, there's some methodological issues of not everybody has a computer and things like that, so you're just getting answers from people who know. But still, it was clear that the more equal the two countries were in gender, the more sex there was, at least outside of marriage. The earlier people started having sex, the more sex partners they had, and so on. So permissiveness seems to increase with gender equality, and that That, again, fits our sexual economic analysis, that when women don't have other means of getting access to the wealth and power and knowledge and so forth that, that basically the men create.
Right. I didn't get to this yet in the show, but I'd like to get your thoughts really quickly. We're running out of time, so I want to get to promiscuity and how it affects sexual market value of both men and women. And I guess by sexual economics, with women being the sellers of sex, it would be asymmetrical. And also, I'd like you to real quickly talk about evolution being different for men than women and the upshot with men creating culture, if that's what you say. So could you go through that pretty like in maybe 3 minutes?
Okay. The first one was promiscuity.
Yes. And market value.
The traditional thing, things may be changing now. We're not sure. But the traditional thing is that the woman's sexual favors had value to the extent they were exclusive. The woman who's had sex with hundreds or thousands of men, like a prostitute, her having sex with her is considered less of a plus than say, a virgin or someone who's only had one or two partners. Promiscuity did reduce the value of the service that the woman supplied as the seller of sex. What effect it had on the men, either nothing or, if anything, it was a tribute to his supposed charm and appeal or something like that. In terms of culture, there's a concrete argument in the book about anything good about men that explains that there, men and women have different social sphere orientations, that women specialize in the one-to-one, the sort of pair bond, the intimate relationship. And men create larger networks of shallow relationships. So if you look at any kind of activity that is based on big groups, that tends to be something men do more than women. The catch is that culture is a system of sharing information and interlocking roles and stuff like that. That emerges much better out of the large network of than a small network. Even just sharing information, the more people you have contributing information to the collective store, the better. So culture essentially emerged from the male sphere. This is an alternative explanation of gender differences instead of the feminist account, which said those evil men banded together and pushed women down. It says, no, men and women had basically separate but equal spheres, but because they're organized the way that they were, progress emerged from the male sphere. And sure enough, when you think of the men created literature and philosophy and science and technology and military organization and economic systems and governmental political systems and so on and so forth, and the women's career sphere really did not create any of that sort of cultural structure of progress. And so it wasn't that the men were being mean to the women or excluding them or exploiting them or knocking them down. Essentially, the men created all this cultural progress, and so the women were left standing outside, hoping that they had something to trade to get a piece of it, which they did with sex being their primary medium.
Yes, well, It's nice that the DJ following me is enjoying the interview, so he's going to let us go maybe another 5 minutes, so that'll be good. I would argue that there is a difference between sexual market value just for the thrill of sex and sexual market value that also adds reproduction. I was going to get into, but I guess next time, women have an attractive figure when they store a certain kind of fat below the waist, which helps for brain development of the child. But anyway, I don't know if you've heard about that or if what you might have to say about the women getting a high sexual market value if it's coupled with reproduction, because I don't think it's just sex. I think it's reproduction, too, in the instinctual genes. What do you think about that?
Yes, well, if you're talking about, just getting a one-time sexual experience, in principle, someone who's had sex hundreds of times with lots of different partners is probably more skilled and will give you a better time than a virgin. But pretty much the world over, as far as I can tell, there's the preference tends to be for the virginal female rather than the one who's been around a lot. So that would presumably reflect the reproductive value. before modern antibiotics, certainly women who had sex with many partners, there's a much higher rate of sexually transmitted disease, some of which impair pregnancy or make one unable to conceive.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there's obviously just an age thing that virgins tend to be younger than women who've had a lot of sex.
Mm-hmm.
The male interest in younger women, which also appears to be pretty universal, reflects, you know, wanting a woman at the start of her reproductive career rather than coming at the end of it. I think David Buss, one of his books, says, well, if the primeval forest, if half the men wanted old women and half the men wanted young women and everybody got what they wanted, well, today we'd only be descended from the men who desired the young women. Because the men who married old women, they might have been perfectly happy and so forth, but those women don't reproduce. They're past menopause. So none of those men had children.
Is there any evidence that it's not necessarily the age, but the mileage, like a fifth pregnancy would be less likely to result in a strong child like a first pregnancy?
I don't know the data on that.
Okay. Well, it's just an interesting question.
Yes, it is.
So let's see here. So let's take a step back now. Because your framework is your interpretation of things, and it always goes back to philosophy. Science is based on philosophy, and if you don't use a sound philosophy, if you're things are self-consistent in reality, at least we expect that. So what do you think about the frameworks we have here? You referenced in your paper that I was reading about sexual economics. There's the feminist construction, which appears to be based on nurture, based on education and cultural experiences. Then there's evolutionary theory. And then there's what you had in the paper, which was sexual economics. And it would seem to me that sexual economics and evolutionary theory are both based on ecology, and we are creatures of ecology, which is the foundation for evolution and natural selection. So what can you say about the different frameworks and how they relate to each other and agree or disagree?
Okay, the different frameworks. The social constructionist idea is that sexual desire is just a product of what you learn and social forces and your experiences and things like that. The other evolutionary perspective is that biology has shaped our sexual desire based on what led to reproduction in our ancient history. So those are the two dominant established views in the field of sexuality right now, and there's a lot of very hostile, acrimonious debate between the two, and you usually look for one side or the other. Now, we've tried to steer a third way. With sexual economics, it's certainly trying to be strongly based on evolutionary principles, which we believe in very much, and certainly recognize the strong contribution of biological factors and natural selection to what people desire. But it's still a system. It's a cultural theory. It's about a social system. In that system, it's whether there are more males or females. That's the supply and demand balance. And people care what others are doing because you're trying to negotiate your own deal to have sex with a person, but it depends very much on what other people are doing and what is the market value, the going rate, how much does the man have to invest to persuade a woman to have sex with him, what determines how valuable she is or whether she's sought after more than her rivals, things like that. So it is both.
And you feel that this sexual economics can bridge the gap between the perhaps feminist educational social construction nurture argument versus the evolutionary theory argument?
Well, the feminist view has a lot of very politically motivated stuff that I'm sorry to say is I find not very well founded and is probably more politically motivated than emerging from sort of scientific inquiry. But the feminist links with a social constructionist view and recognizes that certainly there are contributions of culture and learning and mass media to sex. And we do acknowledge that. But you see, the evolutionary was based on biology. The feminist and social constructionist is basically based on politics. And those are two important fields of inquiry. Ours is based on economics, which is yet another field. But we're saying, look, these principles of supply and demand and collusion by sellers and all these things, these are things that we can use to understand sexual behavior, too. Sex is a very complicated phenomenon, and a lot of different things are contributing to it. So, yes, people are influenced by biology. Yes, there's some influence of situations and power dynamics and things like that. But also supply and demand aspects make a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. So
that leads us back to the symposium you were talking about, where Regnerus was showing, you know, changes in the sex ratio of college helped produce all these changes in sexual behavior.
And for everybody, let me interject that it used to be more men than women went to college, and now it's more women than men go to college, and that seems to be true in Europe as well.
Yes. And so with that change, it's a change in the balance between supply and demand, if women are the supply of sex and men are the demand. And so the price of how much a man has to do to get sex is really much less now than it was in the past on our university campuses.
Yes, yes. So that would work against stable marriage then, because promiscuity would, does that change? I've got some statistics here that I didn't get to that say that the more previous sexual partners a woman has before she marries, the more likely it's to end in divorce. Do you know anything about that?
No, that's interesting. I'd be interested in, I would like to see those numbers. I didn't realize it, but I've had a hunch that that's going to be an issue now, and I'm thinking especially the young men, too, who go through their adolescence having sex without much trouble with lots of different partners, how they are going to settle into a long-term marriage with one of these, especially these entitled women who think, well, we shouldn't have sex until both of us really want to, which is quite rarely. I remember there was a case in that book by Bettina Arndt of a man. He approached his wife and he wanted to have sex, and finally said, okay, I'll just wait until you initiate it, until you're ready.
I remember that.
And it was 9 years
ago.
And they hadn't had sex since.
Wow. That I couldn't stand. Anyway, that's not really the issue, is it? So how much support do you have in the academic community where you can pursue this? I mean, how's your funding? How's your social standing? And how many women are on board with this? And do you feel like you're getting any persecution? Are you Galileo to any extent?
It's been okay. Actually, the stuff on sex is a bit of a sidelight for me. I mean, you mentioned my other book, Willpower. I mean, most of my work in my laboratory research and stuff is based on self-control and how people make decisions and regulate their, restrain their wishes and desires and so forth. So that's been going fine. The sex stuff, it's an issue. Sometimes I have very promising graduate students who say, well, I'd like to do my PhD studying sexual behavior. I like your ideas. I'd like to work with you and so on. Both males and females come, but I kind of have to discourage them. I say it's a risky field. It's very politicized. It's not clear, even if you tell the truth, that people want to hire you. There aren't that many jobs. So I say, unfortunately, get a degree working on one of the more mainstream scientific topics in psychology, and then, like I do, you can do sex research on the side, read stuff, collect some data, publish a paper, a book now and then, pulls it together. But if you're talking about differences between men and women beyond sex, then there's a very strong feminist grip on that idea, on that whole field, and the flow of information is heavily politicized and biased. And as the title of my book, Is There Anything Good About Men? In scientific literature, you're never allowed to say men are better. You can say all the time women are better at this, or you can say there's no difference. But to say, and I believe in trade-offs, so if women are better at one thing, it's probably tied to men being better at something
else. Law of conservation.
Well, something like that, yeah. So I think it almost has to be better in one and different and worse in another. But you really can't ever say the things that the men are better at is a
well,
strong. So that's unfortunate. For scientific progress, we really want to hear all the facts. And I gather Regnerus, who wrote that book and the symposium you mentioned, that he's gotten a lot of grief for some of his findings. But we gotta follow the data and tell the truth and. We don't always like what we find. I know I don't, but still, the truth is better than an appealing lie.
Yes, for some of us, that is absolutely true. I would say for the more civilized of us, but then I'm getting into the politics. So, I forget what I was going to say now. I just went blank. Oh, I want to say who you are. According to your wiki, says you're a social psychologist who is known for his work on the self, social rejection, belongingness, sexuality, self-control, self-esteem, self-defeating behaviors, motivation, aggression, consciousness, and free will. You've authored 500 publications, written, co-written, or edited almost 30 books, earned this is summa cum laude, that's the highest praise from Princeton University for your bachelor's, and then a master's from Duke University. Then you went to Princeton, earned a PhD with your mentor, Edward E. Jones. And so you taught at Case Western, and now you're in sunny Florida. And it's probably a lot warmer there than it is here, but South Carolina isn't too bad.
Oh, yes, it's certainly warmer than Cleveland. Okay, well, if that's Wikipedia, that's remarkably accurate. I don't know who writes that and so on, but those are all correct.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So we have been talking with Dr. Roy Baumeister, Department of Psychology, the Florida State at Florida State University. He is the author of Is There Anything Good About Men? How Cultures Flourish by Exploiting Men, and also Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength, co-written with John Tierney. That came out last year. So I thank you, and this is, as long as I can do this show, this will be an oasis for exploring the truth, and I wouldn't mind having you back on if you wanted to be back on, hint, hint. So thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
All right, well, you have a great rest of the day, and I hope that dishwasher works out for you.
Me too, yes, thanks.
All right, thanks.
Bye.
Bye. So that was Professor Roy Baumeister, Florida State University, and that's my show. Ran a little over because of the interview. I would like to thank DJ Blue for letting me stay a little bit longer into his time. That was very generous of him. I'm trying to look on a live chat here and to make heads or tails of this. Abby Normal is in there. Says, because men have to deal with a glass ceiling and earning 72 cents to every $1 men earn. Also says Jenny Craig, Debbie Fields, Estee Lauder, stuff like that. Women never make large companies. So I guess that's being cynical, and women do make large companies. There certainly are large companies made by women. That is true. But I think if you look at the overall balance of it, and I wonder if feminism changing politics and government regulation doesn't have something to do with that. But anyway, we can debate that. I wanted to bring an expert on. He is certainly not the only perspective that there is out there, but it is a perspective, and it's not me saying what I always say. So there you go. So that's my show, and now it's DJ Blue. Thank you. That was Welcome to Reality. I hope the best show I've ever done. I'm going to sign off to automation and catch you maybe next Thursday, 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Thank you. Bye.